welcome to the Your Favorite Band Podcast, the podcast where we talk to your favorite bands about how your favorite bands became your favorite bands. My name is Brandon. Per usual, my best friend in the entire world, Dave, is with me. Dave, how's it going, buddy?
Dude, just really enjoying the respect that you give me every week.
Can I say this to you? Merry Christmas.
I hope you keep saying it. We've got time, man. We got time.
So Merry Christmas. It's Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Thanks for making this year a little less awful. I love True Crime Podcast, and we're going to kind of get to live that out with a band called The Classic Crime. I'm assuming they're similar because of the word crime. Please welcome Matt McDonald to the podcast. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, Matt.
Absolutely. Matt, do you like a True Crime Podcast?
You know, I did listen to Serial. And that was crime related. So that's about as far as I've gone into it.
Okay.
That's true. Okay. It's a true one.
Is there fake crime podcasts? I guess that'd be just like fiction, right?
I actually did listen to one of those. It was really confusing. I'm trying to remember what it was called, but it was supposed to be kind of going through the War of the Worlds, thing, but it was like a fake, kind of like some girl that was like a reporter, and it was just her like log that she was keeping as she was being a reporter.
Yep.
But it was all fiction. I can't remember what it was called, but it was interesting.
Well, there was the one that we listened to where the girl went in and was listening to the, like, someone thought that they caught an alien on tape or whatever.
Yeah.
And that she was investigating it, and then it turns out that it was fiction. I got halfway through the whole entire podcast.
That's what I'm saying.
I found out that it was fake.
That's
and
it.
I was so angry.
Why
is fiction such a sad thing? I mean, fiction's good for your brain. If you read fiction, it's really good for your imagination and for your relationships. Studies show.
Sure. I love studies. One thing I don't like, though, is thinking something's real and then finding out it's not. Like, I've invested all this time into this thing,
right,
and I'm like, I can't
wait
to find out.
But what if it's real on a different level? What if there's metaphors and narratives within the story that you can apply to your life and in a magical, fantastic way?
I don't want to do that. I don't want to try to have to figure it out. Like,
I don't want
to want to hear something real.
I don't want to open up a can of worms, but Brand, being that Christmas is so near, there is another thing that was the same experience that we've all been through. Where
I don't know what you mean.
Where it's like you think this thing's really a real thing and you really like it. And then you find out it's not as real as you thought, but then at the same time, it's still wonderful, and you almost...
Are you talking about Santa Claus or Jesus?
I was going to say one, but now that you've said that, I didn't know how young the people would be that would be listening. So I'll leave it up in
don't
the air.
Ruin any, if you answer that, you'll ruin half the people's lives that are listening to this podcast right now. So just don't answer it.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be a whole separate podcast. Is this Santa Claus or Jesus? And then it's a question.
If we say no, we will either piss off Santa believers or Christians, and I don't want to piss off either group.
No,
or
they're both very
imagine
angry.
If you could do a twofer right in there, a little baby Christian. So,
Matt, before we dive into the classic crime, what's your favorite Christmas memory as a child?
Oh, wow, what a question.
Ooh, geez. You know, I had a string of bad Christmases, being a middle child in a large family.
Did you ever get hand-me-downs that were wrapped?
No, but like I think my mom just like got me the whatever the leftover gifts. Like, oh, Matthew will enjoy those, and so. But one year, I really wanted a CD player, and that's how old I am. But I was like 13 and I was really into music and I wanted a CD player. I wanted a boombox stereo and I'd opened all the gifts and it wasn't there. And I was like, oh, here we go. Another terrible Christmas for me, the middle child, the long forgotten middle child. And then my mom was like, go look in the closet. And then there was the CD player.
That's the best.
Parents love that crap.
Yeah. Like holding out.
Yes.
Well, I do it too to my kids now.
Like,
so
I
get it.
In the Christmas story, when the kid wants to BB gun and the dad hides it behind the piano, I'm like,
that's
one thing he wants.
Yeah, it was exactly like that. It was like, you want to bring them to the brink of
glistening?
Yeah, you bring them to the brink of collapse and total depression, and then you bring them to joy. And that's kind of a metaphor for how you get to a self-actualized life. You have to go through your suffering.
Exactly. And Jimmy Kimmel's like exploited this to the maximum level, like with his Halloween and now Christmas ones, where it's like, get the disappointment of your children. We love it. We want to see everyone's disappointment, not just my kids, other kids.
Right. Is that how God sees us?
Is that how Santa Claus sees us?
It's just Santa Claus just laughing when we don't get what we want because he knows we're gonna be okay.
God just kind of sees the thing in the corner and he's like, "Hey, what's that over there? Why don't you take a look?"
Yeah, what's the silver lining over there that you're not seeing right now?
You've been praying. What's that over there?
Thanks, Lord.
I love this. This is a very spiritual podcast. I wasn't expecting this.
We'll probably talk about more of that. But I heard you say CD player, which made me want to, as we transition into talking about music, 13-year-old Matt, what's Matt listening to that's starting to get him into music?
I think I had one of those Columbia House subscriptions. If you're old enough to remember those, it's like a mail order thing and you can select like 10 CDs for like 50 bucks or something. But then it's like they try to rope you in on a monthly subscription, and then your parents get mad and call them and cancel it and get a refund.
Nah, classic.
It was
crime.
One of those things where, but I grew up in at that point I was living in a small kind of rural town and there wasn't like cool radio stations or anything. So I would order anything that I thought was like cool and edgy. So it was like Green Day and Nirvana and stuff like that from the 90s. And Alanis Morissette, because it was later in the 90s. Stuff that, like, I'm not, you know, I wouldn't... My parents would have heard it and been appalled that I was listening to it. But all very, you know, edgy, cool, you know, I'm a teenager now stuff. And then I think I got into more, I don't know, like, I never was into, like, indie music until I went to college, because I wasn't exposed to it. I would have been outside of like MXPX, I guess would be, you know, the pop punk band of, you know, my teenage years. But
yeah. Did you grow up in the Seattle area?
So I was born in Vancouver, Canada, BC. And then we moved across the border when I was 10 and it was right across the border in this Dutch farm town. Very quaint. They always win like best main street. There's some award for like the quaintest main street where everyone keeps their grass trimmed to a certain level and everything looks so nice. And
Film all the Hallmark movies.
Yeah, exactly. Football, Cowtown, that whole thing. And then I went to middle school and in high school there. And then after high school, I moved to Seattle and went to college in Seattle.
Gotcha. Cool.
Awesome.
So talk a little bit about how you got into playing music and eventually how you ended up forming what is known today as the Classic Crime.
Yeah. So I actually probably wrote my first song when I was 13-ish around there. Just I'd been playing guitar. I learned guitar when I was 9 or 10, just basic chords, because my fifth grade teacher had for the music period, it was guitar time. He had 26 guitars hung up around the room and we all pulled them down and played Beatles songs and, you know, classic American folk and rock songs. Right. And so I realized I was pretty good at that. Like I could, you know, pick up the chords and I could hear the melodies and I could sing along. And I think in fifth grade we did like a Beatles play.
Wow.
And I remember feeling like all my cool friends were around me, but like when it came time for them to sing or say something, they were really nervous. But then I could sing and say things and get a response out of the crowd, which as a middle child, I was really thrilled by because I was seen, you know, and heard. And I was like, I could do this. This is cool. So anyways, I always had that in me. And then probably 13, 14, 15 started. I think when I was 15, I got an electric guitar and started playing kind of punk rock chords and writing songs and of course involved in like Young Life, which was, you know, like a church sponsored organization that, you know, you have people who play songs, and I became one of the people who played songs and sang. And then, you know, went to camp every summer, which is where I met my wife, and we played songs there. And I was never really like the front man, but I was always like, I can play acoustic and sing harmonies. Mm-hmm. But I wrote my own songs, and I wrote a bunch of songs on a bunch of loose leaf paper. And I met my wife there when I was 15. We started dating when I was about 17. And then, nice. She would come over to my bedroom at my parents' house, and I would bust out my box of loose leaf with scribbled songs on it and play her the songs. And she was really my only audience earlier on. And she liked them, and that, you know, we were able to bond over that, and she could sing along and stuff.
Oh God.
She could sing along. Like, she's good at harmony and stuff. So anyway, so then I moved to Seattle, and I really want to find this band, and I've been playing in a couple bands in high school, and my friend and I moved to Seattle. And he's really good songwriter, but he falls in love with a girl back up north in Linden, where I went to high school. Mm-hmm. And he keeps spending his time up there. And I'm like, well, if you're going to be up there, we're like this band thing. Like, I gotta do this. I want to find a bass player and a drummer and a guitar player, and we're going to form a band. And he's like, whatever. Okay. So I start looking in. Now I'm just going on this whole story now that I'm here, fine? But I assume this is part of what this podcast is. So,
yeah.
So I'm working.
Wait, you mean you haven't listened to the entire, your favorite band?
No, I'm not caught up. I'm not caught up yet.
It's okay. You got time.
I still have to listen to the first one, but I'll get there.
Yeah, over the holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of time, a lot of downtime. Yeah, so I'm working at Eddie Bauer and Old Navy, just as like nice. A salesperson on the floor. And then I'm reading the Stranger, which is the free Seattle newspaper. And in the back of the classified section, outside of the really porny, smutty stuff, is like bands seeking musicians, you know? And yeah. So I would always, you know, scour those on my break. And I saw one ad for Rock Vocalist Wanted. We are a, you know, three piece right now. We have bass, drums, guitar. And I'm like, oh, well, I can sing. So I tried out for this band, and it was Justin, Skip, and Alan, who we basically formed the Classic Crime out of. But I showed up and auditioned and played two of my songs and listened to their songs. And I was just blown away by how like tight and dynamic the songs that Justin and Skip were writing. I was like, well, maybe I can squeeze my songs in there with them because all similar, all the influences they listed in the ad were similar stuff that I was into at the time, which was like Jimmy Eat World and I don't know, Blindside.
Wow.
So then that's how we kind of formed, and that was in 2003.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That is awesome. And you guys started in Seattle, right? This is all happening in Seattle.
Yeah, so I'm kind of downtown Seattle living at the time. These guys are a little bit north in Linwood, and they were going to a different school that was closer there. Okay, and then eventually I moved up to the band house that they were renting. And we just practiced every day, and everybody dropped out of school and got, you know, restaurant jobs and worked nights because we were fairly certain that we were going to be huge. Like, you know, we just had this naive belief that our music was God's gift to man. And and like when we played our songs in the room together, like we used to rock out, like we used to be so sweaty after practice because everyone was so into it. And we were just like, this is the best thing ever. And then our friends would come over and they'd be like, yeah, this is the best thing ever. So we just kind of had this belief, this dogged belief that like, if we hustle, if we do this, if we practice every day and book any show we can book, then we will make it, quote unquote. Right. So that's kind of what we did.
It's a beautiful dream. So one thing that's interesting about your band versus a lot of other bands is that Tooth and Nail is also in Seattle, and a lot of bands moved to Seattle because of that, but you guys are already there. Were you guys aware of Tooth and Nail, or did that just kind of become a convenient thing that you found out about later?
No, yeah, we were aware that Tooth and Nail was in Seattle, but we were part of like a local scene that wasn't really connected to mm-hmm. Tooth and Nail, and we got management in 2004. We'd gotten some songs recorded pretty well. And we got them like promoted on Pure Volume at the time, and it was like the mm-hmm. Pure Picks or the Pure Promos or something like that. in our management, one guy found us and then brought in another guy and basically was like, this song, which was, I think, Who Needs Air at the time. He's like, this song's a hit. We're going to get you signed, blah, blah, blah. So we signed up with them and we did a bunch of showcases for major labels, which was kind of the goal, I think, back then mm-hmm. was to get, right. you know, like major labels could sign a band out of nowhere and develop them and bring them up to,
yeah.
you know, quality, whatever performances. And we did some showcases and I don't think we were really ready. But we did one showcase in LA where we drove down and played at the Troubadour mm. with, The Academy Is, and they were on their first record on Fueled by Ramen and they were just nice. It was just kind of taken off. And so our managers basically got every, you know, pulled every favor they could to get every major label out at that show. We drove down, you know, used to playing locally with all of our friends and fans there, and it's very comfortable and everybody rocks out to, you know, arms folded in the Troubadour in West right. Hollywood. And so it was a weird vibe. And then like in the middle of the third song, Alan, our bass player, like goes to, you know, we were into the whole acrobatics on stage type thing. So he goes to throw his bass like around his body and his strap breaks and it flies across the stage and his guitar breaks.
Oh my so gosh.
He didn't have a bass. So he kind of does the, what we called at the time, the Ashley Simpson hoedown, you know, and it's just like, what do I do? And he's coming up to me in the middle of a song. And like, meanwhile, all these A&R people are like watching us and it was just a disaster. So needless to say, nobody took us out to lunch the next day. And so we kind of drove back home with our tail between our legs and, excuse me, Chad Johnson from Tooth and Nail heard about us through, a mutual friend, came out to another show and said, I really think you guys are like, you know, it. You guys are our next kind of like mainstream thing. So he brings Brandon Ebel out to a show and Brandon loves it. Said something how we're better than all these other bands that he's listened to or whatever. And so we end up signing with Tooth and Nail. And it was kind of a secondary thing. Like we were hoping for like a mainstream thing. And I think Tooth and Nail was hoping for us to be that mainstream launch pad for the for the record label at the time, because they had success with Under Oath at the time and but the Tooth and Nail, like on Solid State, but the Tooth and Nail label, they wanted, you know, Amberlin was kind of breaking at the same time, Emery, but they were like, we need to do more radio, we need to do more mainstream. And so I think us and another band called Jonesetta were kind of their attempt at that. And so us and Jonesetta got really good record deals from Tooth and Nail, and we both kind of started at the same time, got on a bunch of tours together, and, you know, and the rest is history.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I heard you guys for the first time on MySpace. I remember that time when I heard you guys and was like, this is great. Talk about kind of how big social media was for you, even early on in the life of social media, kind of helping your music go beyond the borders of Seattle and Washington and across the country, just using MySpace.
Yeah, I mean, MySpace was huge. You know, Pure Volume was another site that was huge for us. And so it was kind of like the Wild West for indie bands. Bands who, you know, wouldn't otherwise have the financial backing to be, you know, shown to a lot of people had that if they could maintain a decent social presence and stay up to date and keep doing stuff. And so that was huge. I mean, I remember MySpace. I don't even know if we can log into our MySpace anymore. I haven't tried in about 10 years, but it was a big thing. It was the biggest thing. And actually our friends in Sherwood got signed to MySpace records.
The weirdest thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was the biggest thing in the world, obviously, and isn't much anymore.
Yeah, that's so funny. looking at social media now, do you feel like, I don't know if there's as many bands getting big off of just social media as much as they are just getting added to the right Spotify playlist. So how do you feel like the time that you guys were kind of getting in on social media compares to what smaller indie bands have to do now in order to make it?
Well, it's always a hustle. And, you know, we were hustling with all the tools that we had available to us in the time that we had them available. And bands, it's the game is the same. The game has always been the same. Use whatever tools you have available to you to try to get ahead, you know, try to get heard. Right. And, you know, we do that now to some extent. You know, we have an active Facebook page, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, right. Whatever. You know, we just did a crowdfund campaign last May, mm-hmm. where I, you know, much to my dismay, Facebook had started throttling us pretty hard on our posts. So like nobody would see our posts because the algorithm wants you to, you know, pay the for
right. mm-hmm.
that, you know. So, I mean, we really benefited from Facebook in like 2012, but the game had to change eventually when they, you know, did their whole IPO and stuff. So, and they started asking money. And of course we don't have the kind of money to reach the people who want to hear us. So we were kind of screwed. And then they came out with Facebook Live, which changed the game again, because they wanted to make this live platform so that a lot of people would use, because they wanted to compete with Periscope and other competitors. And so the algorithm favored live videos and would put them in the top. And even if you see this on your mobile phones now, you'll see like if someone goes live who you're a friend with, it will like pop out into your newsfeed.
Right.
True.
And like be like, click on me. So I noticed this early on and I was like, oh, I'm going to start going live to talk about our crowdfund campaign and like all the stuff we want to do and the music we want to make. And it went really well. Like we raised more money than we ever had before, just using this one tool. So I think, you know, the tools change, but the game is still the same. You know, it's still what can we do to get in front of the most people? And that hasn't changed since 2003. It's just the way you do it changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Well, moving on into the first album, Albatross, that came out in 2006. Can you talk about the process for that recording and the writing? Did you guys go in with a lot of those songs already written? That's the way like a lot of the debut albums go. Or did you guys write while you're in the studio? What was that like for the first album?
Yeah, we had about six of the songs already written that we had actually demoed pretty well, which we released later. But yeah, we'd written a lot of those songs in 2003 and 2004, and then the record came out in 2006. So a lot of those songs were old for us.
Gotcha.
And then we kind of filled in the songs for the record by writing, some of them by myself, some of them with the band. And then we went with producer Michael Basquet, who's also known as Elvis. Kind of looks like Elvis Presley.
Good.
That is very
but
good.
He was really young, but even at his young age, he had done a ton of like big bands, and he had a total different approach to songs, and he basically taught us how to write songs, like song structure. Like we didn't know. Like we just were doing everything instinctively and didn't know that like, oh, the bridge is the chorus. You know, like we were just like, and he was just chopping things up and moving things around. And I remember it being very uncomfortable, but then when we heard the finished product, we were like, oh yeah, this is how you do it. This is part of the process that we've never incorporated. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, that was, I think Albatross was a huge learning experience for us as far as like generating songs and figuring out what makes a song good, or interesting or compelling throughout the 3 minutes and 30 seconds that it takes to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. That album, actually, I was not surprised, but it was interesting to see it broke a record for Tooth and Nail by selling the most albums on premiere week, which is interesting for them.
Yeah.
So as a band, like you kind of mentioned that you guys felt like you were good and that you would make it, and Tooth and Nail also believed in you, but were you surprised at all by the response and that people were finding you and liking you, or were you kind of, you know, this is what we were expecting type thing?
Well, yeah, it was all kind of measured because we had these super high hopes.
Yeah.
And so anything that fit into that narrative, and we were very young at the time still, like, I think, you know, we got signed when we were 21, 22, which I guess is not that young in the grand scheme of things. But as far as our band was around for about 2 years before that, we had super high hopes, and maybe even, you know, maybe they weren't realistic, and a lot of factors were driving those things. Like people were blowing smoke, or, you know, we had sort of an interior culture of like just we demanded big results. And so I think when that happened and we kind of broke that record for debut album, we were like, yeah, but then what else are they going to do for us? You know, like we had this sort of chip on our shoulder, like we deserve the best. And of course we got that. It's the best record ever. I don't know if that is actually what we thought, but that's kind of how we behaved, which is silly in retrospect, because, you know, I realized I was so young and naive and didn't realize that like this stuff takes time and it takes work and it takes collaborative efforts. And we were sort of taught to believe, I don't know if it was by management or by label or by whoever, that like it was the label's responsibility to make us big. Because clearly we had brought the music that was going to do it. And so, and I kind of regret a lot of those years just because I turned down so many opportunities that I could have had because I was like, I don't want to do that. The label should do that. Or, you know, like people would like have interview requests and stuff. And I was like, I'm just too busy. I was just
that explains why no one responds to my emails.
Yeah.
Because of people like you.
Well, no, it's true. It's like it's like you kind of, I don't know, I was, it was almost, it was taught to me that it wasn't my responsibility to manage my own business. It was my responsibility to be the artist and write the songs. And I couldn't have been more wrong about that. And I realize that now that I'm DIY, that like now that I have the capability and the wherewithal to manage our business does way better. And so the schism or the separation between those two things was, I think, hurtful to our band in the beginning. But it was all part of the learning process that brought us to where we are now. So I'm not, you know, I'm not super regretful. I'm just like, man, if I could go back, like sometimes I'm in my email and I'm like searching for a different email and I'll find something from 2006 where someone messaged me, like someone in relatively important at like an important publication, and I never responded, and I'm just like, oh, what a douchebag. I did not have the right mentality. So
yeah, what you're saying is it's a good thing we didn't start this podcast in 06.
That's really that was like a roundabout.
Yeah, now everyone's desperate to be interviewed, so you're in a good spot.
I guess so. Were you guys, coming out of that album, it did pretty well. Were you, already headlining tours, or were you still doing the opening gig at that point?
No, we were always doing support. So we did, you know, our first nationwide tour was, we opened up for, Mest, Alistair, and Scary Kids, Scaring Kids.
Wow.
And so Scaring Kids and us became fast friends. We went on a bunch of tours together.
Yeah.
After that. But and then the second tour, we ended that tour, drove to Austin, Texas, did South by Southwest, and then jumped on Tooth and Nail Tour 06 with Emery and Amberlynn right after that. And so we did those two support tours, and then we were just only trying to do support tours. Because we trying to get the music out. You know, if we were to headline at that
point. So that wasn't frustrating to you?
No, it was. No, like, I would much prefer to do support tours because I feel like we could be introduced to more people. Sure. But But the reality was, like, even, you know, through 06 and 07, we only made like $100 a night, which was, the gas was really expensive back then. Mm-hmm. So we were really cash poor as a band, and we would sleep in Walmart parking lots. We eventually built bunks into the back of our van. And we were on these big tours, like, you know, playing for 2,000 people a night. And, you know, and then we would go and sleep in Walmart parking lots and then wake up and be like, oh, it's almost like the Cinderella dream has, like, got, you know, what my best story is, like, we played The Fight. So The Fight was a song on Albatross, and it was taken to active rock radio. We didn't feel like we were an active rock band, which is, like, I don't know. At the time, it was like Godsmack and Trapped or something.
Okay, yeah.
And that wasn't really us, but they thought that song had, like, an edge to it that was active rocky, and so they basically serviced it to active rock radio, and we got some radio play. So there was a big festival in Indianapolis called X-Fest at Verizon Wireless Music Amphitheater, and there was 20,000 people there. And I remember we were, like, stuck in line, and we were going to be late for our show because we're opening the set. And we got, like, a police escort with our van and trailer, like, past all these cars, and we're like, holy crap. And then we got back there, and, like, we got our own trailer, and everything's cool. Then we get out on stage, and we're playing for literally 20,000 people.
Wow.
on the show is Godsmack, Rob Zombie, Shinedown, Bullet for My Valentine, Buck Cherry, Alien Ant Farm, 18 Visions, and us.
Love it.
And I was like, what are we doing here? So, but it was crazy. We made great friends with Alien Ant Farm. We like heard their whole life story, and we were just like, this is crazy. We listened to you guys in high school. And then, you know, went out to the bar after, you know, with them and hung out. And then like we woke up in a Walmart parking lot again and we all kind of looked at each other. We're like, well, that's over. But like that was our life. It was from like peak, you know, the highest peaks to the grittiest, lowest, like more just most remedial lifestyles. And that's kind of like where we land. That's just, we sort of we learned to expect that, which is, I think, was really good for our egos, because we had these super high hopes for our band, and then we realized that it was a slog and a right. grind. And and I think it was, you know, I look back and I think that was a great experience.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, that was how we started out. It was $100 a night, barely enough for gas, and sleep in a Walmart parking lot. I've got the solution. You can feed me to something that is leaving this town. Whoa, I'm losing hope. There's a hole in my heart that's been cut out of stone. Whoa, cold comes, cold goes. Could you fill this hole?
So once you kind of had the, I don't know if you want to call it a reality check, but once you kind of saw how things were going with the first album, did that change at all you guys' outlook when going into the second album? Or did you guys kind of still have the same, like, okay, so that one didn't work, this is the one that's going to, like, be the breakout album that's going to just make it?
Yeah, we still had that. We were like, because we, you know, our peers, you know, or people we toured with, we'd seen them have levels of success where they could, you know, afford hotel rooms every night or a bus. I mean, the dream was always a bus, but a bus is $1,000 a day. And if you're not making the money to support that, it's not worth it.
Right.
So, you know, all told. And so we were thinking, oh, we need to be a bus band, because that would just really help with our mental health and our dynamics, you know?
Yeah.
So we're like, let's make the record that's gonna, you know, take us there. Let's make a really sincere, you know, rock record that covers everything, that's expansive and big and shows our depth and maturity. And we were all hands on deck, all in on that one. And that was Silver Cord in 2008, really was the one where I feel like we all were invested, you know, 100%, like every member put in all their, you know, showed all their cards, and you know, we were really proud of that record.
Yeah.
But, you know, no major hits. So what are you going to do?
Right.
Well, yeah, but that, I mean, that album still broke the top 200, got number 123. Did you guys, were you, I mean, it was kind of still at least moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I remember when I heard that, like, we were on Warped Tour and we were on a bus. We were sharing a bus with a band called Sky Eats Airplane. And they were like this, I don't know, metalcore with electronic stuff.
Electronic, yeah, weird.
And they were like kind of blowing up at the time. And like, so we would always just compare ourselves to them. We're like, yeah, we sold, you know, almost 6,000 records in the first week. But look at this band. I mean, they're selling all these shirts and they're making all this money at merch. And like, I don't even understand their music. And then we just felt like out of our element, like, maybe like what we do isn't, you know, it was like a questioning time. Like maybe what we do isn't as good as we thought it was, you know, like maybe the kids these days don't like the stuff we do as much as we do, you know? And, you know, there's these other, and that Warped Tour can do that to you because you see all these other bands that, you know, you mingle with them every night. It's like a barbecue every night. And you mingle with these bands that are like having huge successes. And you're like, I don't get your music. Like, maybe I should do something as stupid as your music.
I heard Sky Eats Airplanes. And I was like, I don't even know what to do with this music.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like,
I mean, nothing bad about them specifically. Yeah, yeah. I thought that they were really musically talented. But there were other bands that weren't, that were also having great success.
Right.
And so I could at least understand if someone's like technically gifted, why technically minded people would be into it.
Yeah,
but there's some of the stuff on Warped Tour, you know, in 2008 was so terrible in an objective opinion. And so we were kind of lost. We were like, what if it's just terrible music? Like, I guess that's what people want. And
what if we're just too good to be popular?
Well, we weren't even technically good, so I can't even say that. Like, we can all write songs, but it's not, you know, we're not shredders. So in that game, we lose. And so I don't know. We were kind of doing, I think, individually some soul searching and going, what are we doing here? Like, we've been on the road for, you know, 3+ years.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the future like?
Yeah.
Right. And this was after the album 2 was released, right? The tours following that.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Just keeping with the timeline. Okay, cool.
And that's when we started headlining more because we couldn't get support tours.
Did you start making more than $100 a night at that point?
We made a little bit more. Yeah, we made up to $500 a night.
Wow. We made $105 a night.
Yeah. And we often got you know, we often got a hotel room at the Econo Lodge where 8 of us piled into. So
that's great. Yeah.
It was a, you know, slightly better existence, but it was still like, this is not what we set out to do.
Right.
You know, this is far below our goals.
It is interesting. Like, I see that you guys, like, when I hear a band broke the Billboard Top 200, like, your mind immediately goes to, oh, yeah, they're doing it now. But, like, I hear you say you guys are, like, still just grinding it. And it's just like, man, at what point do you have to get to like, really, really make it, quote, unquote, make it, whatever that means?
Yeah.
What is the difference between where you guys were at and how much further would you have had to go before you were like, I think we've made it type thing?
The bus, right?
Yeah, I mean, for most of us, it was the bus. Yeah, It was, if we can get into a bus and have that be like financially affordable for every tour, then we would be, you know, cool with that. Cause that would be some level of like comfort in our lives. And that's really what it came down to. But the funny thing is there's bands and buses that just break even on every tour because they're spending so much on their bus and their crew and their production. So
that's the equivalent of someone driving a fancy car that's like mid-level job.
They can't really afford it, right? But they have, I mean, the thing about being on stage in front of a lot of people is your ego thinks you can afford it.
Right.
Because
yeah.
everyone loves you. And then you look at the numbers and you go, this doesn't really add up. Luckily for us, we realized that. Give me your poison pills, 'cause I'm taking my stuff.
third album, like as I was listening back to it today, it almost seems like it's like an arena rock album type thing. Like these songs were meant to be played in front of this energetic crowd. Did you guys go into the studio for that one? Feeling the pressure. You talked a little bit about being independent. You don't feel the pressure. Was there a lot of pressure going to that last Tooth and Nail album, take this to the next level and start playing bigger shows? And so because of that, we're going to play these, bigger songs and make an album like that. Was that kind of the thought process going into it, or am I reading into it?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I wouldn't consider our third record to have the bigness. We kind of went into it thinking, oh, we want to tone this down. We want to have a garage rock. Like we wanted to have it sound rough and edgy and like not so polished and big and anthemic. And sure. Of course we always have the anthem is in our bones. Like that's kind of what gets us going. And, yeah. So that comes out, but I would say Vagabonds, the third record, was more just, I made a bunch of demos, and because everyone was so checked out and so kind of jaded, the demos made the record and nothing really changed. So, they were layered and, we did record them. But as far as like, I was used to going to the studio and then like studio magic happened because people were all invested in the parts and in the songs. And that just didn't happen. And I remember feeling like very depressed about that on Vagabonds. And then, years later, I'm, in a living room show with my wife and, someone says something about our favorite record, of the classic crime. And I'm like, I don't know. I think maybe it was Silver Cord or something back then. And like three or four people are like, no, it's Vagabonds. And I'm like, what? Like, what? That's the one that like made me super depressed. To make. So it just goes to show that you can never go wrong just making things and putting time and energy into them. Even if, I know I'm sort of grading this on like how much people like it, which I don't think that's a good reason to make things. I think you should make things that you like. And if you like them, there's a good chance other people might, but
it's a great point.
But like I did feel bad about Vagabonds because the vibe had so changed, and it is nice to know that like some people are like, yeah, I don't care for your other records, but I like Vagabonds. Like, I just like that. I like that people are into it for that reason. But no, we didn't write it specifically to like, there's one song on there that they were like, oh, this could be for radio. And that like became like Solar Powered Life, which is nothing like anything else we'd written before. It was just a song for my wife who was, seasonal affective disorder, like she needs sunshine, and so I wrote a song about it, and then I think the producer was like, yeah, that's going on the record, and my band was like, no, it's stupid. and then they're like, yeah, that's the single, and I was like, whatever, I don't care anymore.
That's
you guys pick. Our band kind of realized that it wasn't going to happen at that point, as far as all of our dreams and goals. After that came out, it was like, okay, that is what it is. And Justin left the band, founding guitarist who wrote a bunch of songs originally. He went to go to school to be a nurse. And so we're sitting here, a four piece, and kind of it all falls to me as far as how to figure out what we're going to do. And so, excuse me, my voice is really scratchy right now.
You're fine, man.
So my wife gets pregnant. I realize, the label, basically they tried to renegotiate our final option on our deal. And we were like, no, thanks. It's just not working. We'll go it alone. And so we did. And then my wife and I are with child, and she has a bucket list thing that she wants to do. Before I have a baby and my life is over, I want to you know, I want to sing on some songs with you and record it. And so I begrudgingly did it. And I thought it was going to be a terrible waste of my time. And I needed to be thinking about our future of our family. And I was trying to get into real estate and do these real estate courses because clearly music wasn't going to do it for me. No one's knocking on our door. And the classic crime never made any money. And so we're done. And I do this little project and I was like, you know, this is kind of good. It's four songs. It's acoustic. It's piano. It's me and her singing. I'll put it out and I'll put it out like on Bandcamp with a pay what you want option. So, and we'll kind of say like, whatever you want to pay, we'll go to like diapers for the baby. Right. And people paid like a ton more than what, and they really liked the music than what we asked for. And so I was like, dang, independent is kind of the jam. I didn't realize that like you could make money from album sales. Right. And this is in like 2011. And so then I thought, well, I'd seen Five Iron Frenzy's
Kickstarter.
Right. Oh, yeah. And I was like, they're independent. They want to make a new record. They do this Kickstarter and you can pre-order their record and that'll be their record budget. And I was like, that's brilliant. So I said, well, we'll do one final record with the Classic Crime guys. I'll produce it. Cause I'd been doing recording and stuff. And so we put it up there for, you know, half of our lowest record budget on Tooth and Nail. We thought we could do it for half of that. And, it ended up raising like almost 300% of the, what we asked for.
Yeah.
So, and so my mind was blown. I was like, out here, I was thinking that like the Classic Crime was a nobody band because I was counting numbers. You know, I was going, you know, my life is, you know, pretty remedial and, you know, I'm pretty poor. And so people don't care about my music. But what we got out of that Kickstarter was a resounding, yes, we care. Yes, we want more. And that really invigorated us to make a great record. And so we made what I think is, well, I don't know if it's our best record, but it's up there. Phoenix in 2012 was totally crowdfunded. And that's kind of what sort of launched my DIY career, where I answer emails and tweets from random podcasts like yourself.
There you go.
And just get on that hustle and talk to anybody and everybody. And it's a totally different mindset than how we started. But I think the path has kind of led, you know, me to this. And, you know, I will say that we make more money now selling way less records and touring way less than we did in all of the aughts. So
yeah,
right. 2006 to 2010, we had our biggest records and didn't make any money. So
right. We
sort of figured out and everybody has side jobs and stuff now. So it's like, you know, everybody has their own businesses they're running and we kind of take a few weeks a year and tour and do stuff. And it's really a supplementary income, which is a lot less pressure.
Yeah.
I think to try to like provide for your family with something that's so, you know, vague and random. So it's, it's been working out.
It's got such a variable on it as much as you'll make and stuff. Yeah.
Right. You never know. Like people could like not buy the record or not show up to the shows. Like you just don't. So you kind of have to do it for fun.
What was it like trying to have a budget, like do a budget during that time?
For Phoenix?
Yeah. I mean, just before when you're trying to like, when you don't know how well an album's going to do you just kind of put a question mark on your budget? It's like, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. No, that was like Christy, my wife, worked in advertising at the Seattle Times newspaper. And so she basically paid all the bills from 2007 to 2011 for our family.
There you go.
And whatever I brought in was like extra grocery money, but
yeah,
I wasn't a part of the budget at all.
Yeah. Well, and
so,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say you mentioned that you were going to produce a record. Well, you were going to basically do the recording for. Was that the third or the fourth that you said you were going to do that?
Fourth.
Okay.
I did it. Yeah.
And so at what point were you building? Was it during the third album that you kind of, when you said you made those demos that you started learning how to do that and working that out? Or at what point in this journey did you just say, I'm going to start kind of trying to learn how to do this stuff? the producing?
Well, part? I went to audio production school in Seattle. That's where I was going to school.
Oh, okay.
And so
cool.
I kind of learned the basics of Pro Tools.
There you go. Got
and it. I'd recorded some demos for our band, like at the get go.
Wow. Okay.
Cool. And so I always recorded our demos, but I'd never tried anything bigger. And then I started working with some friends on some projects and helping them, you know, write songs and record their stuff. And so I kind of had gotten to a point where I felt pretty comfortable. Not mixing, yeah, but tracking and like working on arrangements and producing.
Yeah.
Gotcha. For sure.
So going into Phoenix after you've successfully campaigned it, it's kind of this new season for the band, rejuvenated. What was the thought process musically with this one? In comparison to the other ones, were you guys trying to keep things relatively the same, or were you wanting to shake things up a little bit and just kind of talk about that writing process, both musically and lyrically, in comparison to the other ones, since this was completely independent?
Well, I think, I don't know, every band says this, but I score high in change on personality tests, and so I never want to do the same thing twice. It's, right, it's soul stealing for me to think about making the same record twice. And so every record I feel like we've broken new ground, and that's kind of been the goal: go somewhere where we haven't gone before. And Phoenix was exactly that, but it also documented kind of the almost like the death of our band, or like that old model or old kind of ideal of what our band would be. And, you know, there was sort of like a mourning process that went along with that when Justin left and the label kind of fell away, and we were kind of left on our own, where I went through, I would say, maybe a bit of a depression and just trying to figure out, like, what am I doing with my life? My whole life has been oriented around, you know, my entire 20s been oriented around this band being the thing, and I don't know who I am anymore. And I was, you know, I was doing, like I said, I was doing real estate courses and, you know, writing this record, like, but really longing for music to be the thing. And so I think Phoenix documents a lot of that, of just self-doubt, death of our band. There's a song on there called Dead Rose, which is basically a metaphor for this. The band is the rose is a metaphor for the band. It just grew naturally and it was beautiful, and then it died and the petals fell to the ground. Oh, it's boy. Like really emo.
Gosh. Oh man.
And it's still one of my favorite songs on the record because it is sincere. It's something that I was going through and trying to sort out. But we also were, I was also trying to push boundaries. You know, musically, we came out with the song called The Precipice and a song called The Beautiful Dark Side, which I'm really proud of both of them for doing something different. The Precipice is kind of a folk song, which our band had never done before. The Beautiful Dark Side is kind of like an indie rock song that has this like these strings and these tension notes that like go throughout it. And it's minor and it's groovy and it has like falsetto in the chorus and just stuff that I wasn't, normally I would just be like, and then kick it on the chorus and we're just going to yell and, you know, shout and group vocals. And that was kind of our band. That was our default. And people are like, yeah, we love that. And I'm like, I can do that in my sleep. I don't want to do that anymore. So, trying to like just venture out into more subtle areas of songwriting and trying to do things a little bit more creatively. That happened on Phoenix. And I think, you know, that's probably what I'm most proud of is,
right,
musically kind of stretching out a bit and listening to other stuff and really trying to not fit into our genre.
And you kind of hinted at this earlier, but at the same time is when your wife was talking about before the baby, she wanted to do the project. And so can you talk about like the kind of the timeline between trying to juggle those two things? Because also the funny thing is that when you mentioned everything that you've talked about so far about you guys' mindset, it seems like the Vocal Few has a lot of songs like the We'll Make It Someday that are kind of,
yeah,
that are explaining exactly the feelings going on during the prior time. It's almost like a,
right,
like reflective music about,
but it's like happening. It's a new naivete because it's, right, not, it's not like We'll Make It financially with success and you know, respect and admiration. It's not, right. We'll make it that way.
Right.
It's like a different, we'll make it. We'll make it because we're okay, because that life is an adventure, because.
Right. That's exactly.
You know, and it's a new naivete. It's a new, like, we were naive and ignorant, and now we're naive and in a way that's not ignorant. It's, we know that life is not going to give us exactly what we want, but we will be okay. Mm-hmm. It will be okay. And that was kind of the newfound sense of belonging that, you know, you just kind of throw, like, when the material stuff doesn't add up, you just kind of toss it out and you go, you know what? I'm still going to do this. Right. No matter what, I'm still going to do this. So, and I'm going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You know, despite what the numbers are, which is kind of an F you to the traditional way of,
right,
you know, running a business, but, or it's sort of an F you to the business in general. It's like, I don't need you, business. We're going to just travel and play and write songs. And that's what life's about. It's not about getting to some other place. It's about right now. So
that's awesome. And so, yeah, what was it like, having that on the horizon at the same time as doing this album?
Yeah. So, Vocal Few was kind of our first parlay into DIY stuff. Mm-hmm. And where I realized that, number one, people, I don't know, I had a lot of self-doubt and I was like, you know, maybe we aren't that good and maybe we just fooled ourselves, and or just maybe people just don't like our band. Maybe we're just like all those other bands that fall away and we're just going to fall away and that's done. And I don't know, the going DIY, doing the Kickstarter, doing Vocal Few kind of reaffirmed that that's not the case,
yeah,
that people do appreciate our music and do appreciate our perspective and the songs we write. And so I figured that was kind of when we realized, like, regardless of what happens, there is this group of people, you know, I think it was like 2,000 people on our first Kickstarter. That's not a ton of people. Like, if right. you sell 2,000 records, it's not a big deal. But if you have 2,000 people back you on Kickstarter and say, yes, I want your new record without even hearing it,
right,
then all your obligation is to those 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. There's not all this pressure of, like, blowing up. There's not this pressure of selling millions of records. It's just, I want to deliver the best record for those 2,000 people. And that became really simple. It, like, simplified the whole situation for me. If we can do this, if we can put out music that these people will enjoy and appreciate, and they appreciate us for a reason, that our music is sincere. And so if we can do that, like, without selling out or whatever,
right,
then they'll come back the next time and pre-order our album. And those 2,000 people will fund another album and we'll be able to make that. And then when should this end? It doesn't ever have to end. It doesn't, right, have to be us shooting for the stars. You know, it doesn't have to be us, like, quitting. We don't have to do in either of those extremes. We can just do the work that's right in front of us. And that, right, is delivering the music these people want to hear. So,
yeah,
it became really simple. Like, the whole thing became simple and stress-free due to doing this kind of DIY and Kickstarter stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
I wish I could play piano well. I'd hit the keys that make your spirit swell. And if you sang along, we could write the saddest song. I dreamt I stood on a hill that I wished was a mountain.
So you guys guys have had success with Kickstarter, and some other bands have had miserable experiences with Kickstarter, and you seem to be enjoying the independent life versus the record label life. For bands that are like starting out and the idea of being independent is really attractive to them because they get to, you know, keep their money and all that stuff. But also, like, at the same time, Kickstarter was successful for you because you guys had built the fan base due to the record label. So what would you say to those bands starting out that are like, we just want to stay independent and try, what would you say to them? Would you say like, yeah, try that? Or would you say the record label actually helped us out a lot down the road, be able to be independent?
Yeah, I would say the record label did help develop us as a touring band and got us a lot of opportunities. But we started the same way as any other band. The only difference is now you have to, like, the internet is ever more a tool. So
yep.
Getting your music out there, you don't need a record label to do it. But the hustle is the same. The story is the same as far as what you have to do. It's just every day you go to work for your band and your music. And I wouldn't say do a crowdfund if you don't have fans. I would say you have to develop a fan base. People, and they have to be core fans. They have to be a big enough fan base of core fans, because people who just casually like you aren't going to pre-order your record before they hear it. So you have to have enough people that really like you and really want you to put out another record. And in order to do that, you have to work, you know, for years to build that momentum. And, you know, it starts the same way as it always started, locally, playing shows. You know, someone told me the other day, like 21 Pilots, like, sold out a bunch of big venues in Columbus, Ohio before they got signed.
Yep.
Because they had this hustle, you know? Yep. And that was only like 2 or 3 years ago or whatever. I don't even,
right.
It wasn't that long ago. And they're not like an old band. They're not old like me.
Right.
They're newer. So the game's the same. You know, if people like you, you can put music out. If enough people like you, you can put music out, and you can afford to do it because they'll pay you to do it. There's nobody in between. You don't need the management. You don't need a label. You don't need a connection or a handshake to someone special. Your music is your product. Your music is the thing that people are attracted to, and they're not going to buy it unless it's great. So work on your music first, and then hustle, hustle, hustle to get as many people to hear and experience your music and vibe. And that's what I would say to new bands. I mean, I don't think the game's changed at all.
Yeah,
that's awesome though. The way that you've kind of come into this, the DIY thing, like, it's a really cool place to be at for you guys right now. And actually, another podcast that I used to listen to a lot, I still listen a little bit, but it's called The Art of Manliness. I don't know if you guys heard of that one, but he basically interviews people on any topic that he can somehow justify as a manly topic. And one of the ones that he interviewed was a guy who wrote a book. I can't remember what the name of the book was, but the premise of the book was like how to have adventures once you like have kids and you're like in your normal life, like how to still have.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so basically
I love that whole concept. That's like one of my main goals in life.
Exactly. Okay. So this, like, one of the things he said you could do, he goes, a lot of people are always trying to plan like a camping trip. He's like, one day tell your wife that you're not going to come home that night, just one night, and bring like a sleeping bag to work, and then go to work. When you get off work, go find like a random like hill, and then just sleep under the stars that night, and then come back. And then it's like, that's it. Simple. It's things like that. Just all these weird little things, but also how to like do a day, like an adventure day with your kids. But what I'm getting at is that at the same time that I listened, around the time I listened to that podcast, I listened to the first Vocal Few record, and it had the same exact feeling to me. Maybe it was just because that's where my headspace was, but it had this kind of like, hey, your life can be exciting. Just like your life, you know what I mean? And I thought that was a really cool brand for you guys to come up in with, which is also kind of seems like is the same case with the way you're describing this part of you guys' career. It's just this thing where it's like, you know what? We know we now have a realistic idea of what things are, but that doesn't mean that it can't be exciting still. Like, we just now have expectations there and stuff that are correct.
We were as delusional. So two parties are delusional. The in the parasocial relationship, the person who believes they're special and different and unique and celebrated, the celebrity, if they believe that, they're delusional. Mm-hmm. Also, the people who prop up that by affirming the celebrity's uniqueness and specialness, mm-hmm, outside of, or like a beyond their own uniqueness and specialness. So like, we were delusional, and people who thought we were awesome were delusional too. And if I can do one thing in life, it's like, I want to break down those delusions. I want to show people that we are real, normal, regular people who slept in Walmart parking lots, right, who enjoy sunshine, who enjoy travel, and you too enjoy the same things as us. And we can all have the thing we want. It's not this pie in the sky when you die. It's not this, you know, it's not accepting an award on a stage. It's, yeah, it's going camping with your family. Everybody, right, at a base level can enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And so don't long for some other thing. It's right in front of you. And that was a realization that happened right around, you know, starting my own family and you know, having a kid and realizing the real basic parts of life, not the stage performances or the traveling or the meeting celebrities or whatever, just the real looking into my daughter's eyes. I was like, everybody can experience this. And I'm not special. I'm special because I get to do this normal thing. Mm-hmm. And there's something special about normalcy. And I think, yeah, I think you're dead on when you say that that was the vibe that kind of surrounded that first EP.
What was the writing and recording process like with doing it with your wife versus the band? I mean, because obviously that can cause a lot of complications trying to,
yeah,
do that. But how did you guys tackle the issue of having that together and writing together and stuff?
It's been a growing experience for our relationship because, you know, normally work and family are very separate. And she is, you know, she's a great singer. She can like lock in on any harmony and just nail it. And she plays piano and she's like classically trained, but she like is really insecure about doing both. Originally was really insecure about doing both at the same time. And just insecure about like me, cause I'm kind of a guy that I just do things and I don't think about other people's feelings. And I just, you know, and so she was, you know, really insecure about how she was performing, or, you know, if I would say do that again, she'd be like, why didn't you like it? And I'm like, no, I just want you to do it again. Like, there's just weird communication stuff where like she would take things on a deeper level than I meant them. I was just in work mode. And so, right, we had to sort a lot of that stuff out, but, yeah, but we're way better now. We had plenty of fights starting out, but I think it's, you know, all those things sort of inform our life now, and I think have helped us to become closer over the years. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So talking about Classic Crime now, your last album you guys put out was like a redo type thing of old songs. Which, yep, is great. So what's next for you guys? Are you guys are you writing new stuff for Classic Crime? Are you guys doing a, yep, new album? What, tell us about what's coming up for you guys.
So the record's done.
Great.
We've recorded it. We crowdfunded it last May. We did a tour, like a 10-year anniversary tour, and a crowdfund around the same time. And then we recorded it in August, mixed it and mastered it in September. It is done. And it will come out next year because, nice, we don't want to fight the holidays. But yeah, I'm really excited for this one. It's a lot different. I took a totally different approach. One of those self-limiting, cool, approaches where I,
right,
decided I was not going to write on acoustic guitar. I was just going to program drum beats and then do bass and then write a completely different, the opposite way that I normally do.
Oh,
and
wow, that's cool.
I think the songs are like, for that, because of that, it are way groovier and kind of locked into a feel that, you know, there's a lot more time signature stuff because I just got bored with the drums. I'm like, oh, I don't want to make a 7/4. So there's stuff, yeah, just when you limit yourself to like stuff, you're like, I'm just going to do it this way. I think it's one of the things I've realized is that we think, you know, if I get more tools, I'll be better. But when it comes to creation, I think sometimes when you take the tools away, the creative side of your brain has to be more creative to make it interesting. So that's kind of was the approach to this record. And I think I really like how it turned out. So I'm excited for people to hear it. It'll come out.
I'm really excited. That's going to be sweet.
April or May 2017.
Great. I'm excited. I've listened to a lot of Classic Crime over the last 24 hours. And I confess I hadn't in a while. It had been a minute. And man, I fell back in love with the Classic Crime. I loved you guys. I was one of the ones that was naive enough to think that you guys were great. But
your delusion was shattered, yeah, and so now you're better for it.
Yeah. So somewhere along the line, I was like, well, "These guys aren't great." I'm kidding. But now I
prefer that.
I'm delusioned again. I am so excited. I can't wait.
Redelusioned.
Redelusioned. You've pulled it back.
Reblowing up. When I tour with Emery, they always say, "We're reblowing up." How many kids showed up tonight? 350. Reblowing up.
Reblowing up.
Those guys are reblowing up, and I love it for them. It's fantastic. Tell the people before we play a Christmas song. Tell the people where they can find out more Classic Crime and the Vocal
Few. Vocal Few. Yep.
Sure. Yeah. The Classic Crime mostly just runs on our Facebook page right now, facebook.com/theclassiccrime. But I am building a website for our new release in the new year. So theclassiccrime.com. Yeah. The Classic Crime. Well, no, Squarespace. But
build a beautiful
the Classic Crime. Yeah. Theclassiccrime.com will be live soon. Right now, vocalfew.com is kind of the active one, which is my wife, Christy, and I's project. Beautiful. And we put out a Christmas, or I guess a winter EP called Snowdrift EP that has five original winter Christmas inspired songs. That
it's awesome. It's awesome. I was listening to that a lot.
Three sad ones and two happy ones.
That's balanced. But
yeah, so vocalfew.com if you want to check that out. There's links to like iTunes and Spotify and all that.
Love it. We wanted to end with one of those, if that's okay with you. And I'm going to let you pick whatever one you want to end with to help say, hey, Merry Christmas, everyone.
I think we should end with a song that's the final song on the record. It's a dumb, simple acoustic song called Cheers to Your Holiday. And I think it sort of embodies some of the stuff we're talking about. The stuff that really matters versus the stuff that doesn't. And I think people can relate to it. And it's not like, you know, super complex song, but I think it shares the Christmas spirit well. Great. So,
well, Matt, Merry Christmas. cheers to the holidays, my friend.
Yeah. Anything else that you want to plug that's going on?
Your podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I do podcast. Don't Feed the Trolls is the name of my podcast with Nate Henry, who is the singer from Sherwood, that MySpace band we talked about. Uh-huh. We talk about starving our creative trolls and overcoming creative blocks to do good things in the world.
That's awesome.
And through a number of different topical things. So, yeah, Don't Feed the Trolls on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Cool.
Perfect. Matt, thank you. Go check out the Classic Crime and the Vocal Few. And here is Cheers to the Holiday. Merry Christmas, friends.
Merry Christmas.
Cold snow, warm glow, hot cocoa for the kids. Mom, Dad, cognac, and apple cider sips. So cheers trap, stressful budgeting, checklist, Joneses, it isn't what it means. Sit still, listen, the only gift you need is how you live. So here it is. Cheers to your joy.